Well, praise the Lord, everyone. It's Dr. Michael Morris again for God's Glory Ministries, bringing you Bible study on CD. It is indeed an honor, a privilege, and a pleasure to bring you these Bible study sessions. This is Bible study number 68, and we will be covering the book of 1 Corinthians chapter 11. First, we'll have our quiz. We have 8 questions on this quiz, and beginning with number 1, this is a true or false question. Is this statement true or false? When God gives people miraculous blessings, they are more likely to serve Him. That is false. Question number 2. Church attendance does not measure your relationship and commitment to God. That is true. Now, question number 3 is a bonus question. Okay? So get ready for this one. Okay. Now, who oversaw the molding of the gold into a calf to worship for the Israelites? The answer is Aaron did. Okay, on to question number 4. God was disappointed, angry, frustrated, and most of all, jealous because of the children of Israel. Why was that? The answer is because they put other things ahead of Him and gave credit to others for what God had done. Question number 5. The children of Israel were defiant and ungrateful. Is this true or false? The answer is true. All right then, question number 6. This is another true or false question. God expects us to maintain our allegiance to Him and that we have faith toward Him as well as an accurate recognition of who He is and proper reverence for Him as God. That is a true statement. Question number 7, another true or false. God never allows us to be tested beyond our human ability. That is true. Final question, question number 8, another true false. God making a way of escape from sin means to avoid it, not get you out of a jam once you've gotten yourself there. Is that true or false? That is absolutely true. All righty then, folks. That was a lot quicker than I thought it would. That's 8 questions. I hope you did well on the quiz. If not, you'll get them next time. Or listen to the CD over again, and I'm sure you'll get them all right this time. All righty. So we're going to get on to our study of the book of 1 Corinthians, chapter 11. Okay, now, as I prepared for this Bible study on chapter 11 of the book of 1 Corinthians, a few things kind of jumped out at me that I'd like to share with you. First of all, even though this chapter has 34 verses in it, there really are only 2 major subjects covered, and that will make covering this particular Bible study easier for you to digest. Now, the other things that struck me are in the background or under the surface for us, but would have been quite obvious to those that Paul was writing to. Now, first of all, nearly all of the issues that we've been covering in the book of 1 Corinthians have been about really the non-essentials. These are issues that in and of themselves are not the most critical, certainly not to salvation. They become critical, however, to solve because of disharmony or chaos that occurred in the church because of the issues. Now, there are certain actions and attitudes that make situations unacceptable to God, where actually the underlying subject was not one that determines salvation or not. But in the end, the actions and attitudes were unacceptable to God. Now we will see that this will actually be true. It'll be more obvious to you as we study the book, chapter 11. But along these same lines, I think that it's important to understand that Paul was problem solving here in these letters like this. And the most important doctrinal issues really had already been covered in his 18-month stay. He certainly would not spend 18 months and leave any doubt about the essentials of salvation and following Christ, okay? But there are so many problems and life situations that could occur in every city. Paul had to respond to the numerous problems in his letters. Now, this is the reason why there's been so much debate on these very non-essential issues. There's just so many subjects or issues that have no straight right or wrong answer. And it depends on the cultural situation and in some ways the social mores of the time and the place that's being discussed or questioned. Now, that doesn't mean that the church should march to the drum of the world. Absolutely not. But as we've seen before, where salvation is not threatened, okay, we are taught to do what is expedient. Paul says that over and over again and shows us many examples of it. Now, this is not what's the easiest or what feels the best, but it is what is best for your brother, your sister, or the church in general. What's best for the glory of God and the spread of his gospel message? And this is much of what you find in the writings of Paul. Taken in that proper context, it's a lot easier to adopt into your life the teachings that Paul is trying to get across, not only to the folks that he was writing to at the time, but all the way down to us. But all too often, unfortunately, we are guilty of weakening the church as a whole because we bicker about subjects that we really don't need to. Now, there are so many issues that Paul adjudicated in his day that if you take it word for word down here in the 21st century, it just simply does not apply. And unfortunately, we end up arguing over these subjects and we really don't need to. But what always applies, however, are the concepts and the expectations behind his instructions and his advice. Jesus himself did not cover every subject while he was here on earth. But the most important ones, you better believe, he did cover and over again. The same thing, really, with Paul. When he would set up a church, they were always given the essentials and more. And usually he'd send somebody back like Timothy to reinforce those things, okay? But not every problem could be anticipated. So like Jesus often did, Paul fielded the questions as they were posed to him, either verbally or very often in writing. Now, we've seen many examples of subjects that require tailoring to the time and place and circumstance. Divorce was one of them, but there were just so many others. And not only did Paul not mean to project most of his advice down through 20 centuries, I think it's clear from his writings that, like most of those in his time, he really had no reason at all to believe that Jesus would delay his return nearly this long. There's no question that he scolded the Thessalonians, as you may recall, about being lazy, slothful, and focusing as if Jesus was going to come any moment. There was nothing wrong with them believing he was coming any moment, but if they acted as if their lives had no other purpose other than to stand and look up at the sky, he clearly did not encourage that. But there's no doubt, if you read his writings, he, along with the rest, felt that Jesus was indeed coming soon. So Paul, fortunately, was, however, very uniquely gifted and prepared to deliver the message of salvation to the Gentile or the Western world at the time. And notice how different the issues were for Paul the ones that he had to deal with, as opposed to those dealt with by James. The only thing that they really had in common on the surface of it is the Judaizing issues. You know, Paul had to blend and balance an ancient religion of Judaism with its most recent permutation of Christianity. And all of this coming from the non-dominant or the minority people of the day, you know, out of the Jews. So that was a huge challenge. And then all of that up against the controversy, the ongoing controversy of his very apostleship itself, as well as persecution by Jews and Romans on the church. And then in addition to that, the challenge of the entrenched cultural and religious norms of the Gentile world at the time. So it was a very daunting task that Paul was asked to perform by God, but he was also uniquely capable and gifted for the job, as well as energized and he had a great deal of passion for what God had asked him to do. So these are the types of things that Paul was addressing for his time, contemporary issues with the background of a very ancient religion of the minority peoples of the time and place. Now, it will be up to us to take these preserved writings in the Bible and to get the most knowledge of God's will and his ways as we possibly can from these writings. And the Old Testament message is really no different from the New Testament message. The only additions really were, number one, that Jesus challenged the religious leaders and believers of the time to see the spiritual meaning behind things that were in the Old Testament. And the reason that he wanted them to do that was because that's what really mattered all along. You get it? And you may recall when we read the book of Luke, that's exactly what you'll see Jesus trying to do. And then the other thing that was in addition was the fulfillment of the Messiah's work in the cross, and the fact that the cross is saving power through the shedding of Jesus' blood as a sacrifice for all mankind. Whoever would receive him, that was new compared to the Old Testament. Not that it was not foreseen in the Old Testament, not that it wasn't prophesied, but it was certainly a new concept to the majority of the Jews. Now, one other thing that I'm reminded of as I study this particular chapter is how, on top of all the other barriers that I've mentioned, there was always again that language thing cropping up and creating more difficulty for us as we study it, particularly in the King James Version. This particular chapter, especially so, it was written in plain language and in simple terms. And for those who were reading it at the time, it was crystal clear. And I actually feel like it is very important that you get the same clarity that they were able to get, so that you can incorporate the same learning into your life without any ambiguity or frustration with any translational issues. And once we read it, I believe you'll see what I mean. And for this reason, I'm going to read exclusively from the Amplified Version of the Bible during this session, and I pray that you are blessed by that decision. And now the last issue that I would like to bring to your attention, is the fact that Paul hoped, as Jesus had, that the repeated underlying message in the basic teachings would have been adhere to more and would guide the people more. Unfortunately, they did end up dealing with lots of other issues. There's no question they both would rather to have spent much more of their time focusing on the goodness of God, the spiritual nature of our relationship with God, and our relationship with him as his creation. Also the role of the Messiah, that the Messiah played in the evolution of man's relationship with God, and also God's expectations that we love God and each other. But especially Paul, he ended up dealing with lots of other side issues. Jesus was forced to focus on issues and challenges that came from the religious establishment at the time. So in the case of Paul, again, he is receiving many, many questions from the various churches, in this case Corinth, and he is doing his level best to respond to those as a good shepherd from a far distance. And so in the end, you've seen up to this point, and you will continue to see, Paul erring on the side of caution and his directions to the church. He never wanted God's name to be tainted by the reputation of the church, and he did everything he could to protect that reputation. And he never wanted Christians to fall because of the liberties available to other Christians. And that's why he told us to do what is expedient, even though other things may be lawful unto you. And so he felt this way whether they were Jew or Gentile, even though he was called largely to be a missionary to the Gentiles. And so Paul clearly would never want anything to hinder the spread of the gospel, and that comes through quite loud and clear in all of his writings. All right, so with that as a preface, a preparation, I think we're ready to tackle the book of 1 Corinthians, chapter 11. All right, now, as I mentioned at the beginning of the CD, there are only two main topics here in this chapter. The first one is that of women's headdress, especially in worship, and the latter subject is that of the Holy Communion. Now, this chapter also is varied in its tones in the two sections. Initially, Paul is complimentary to the Corinthian brothers and sisters, and I'll tell you why in a minute. But from verse 17 on, he is clearly not complimentary. So let's go ahead and read the first two verses of chapter 11. Again, I'm reading exclusively from the Amplified Bible. Verse 1. Pattern yourselves after me, or in other words, follow my example, as I imitate and follow Christ, the Messiah. I appreciate and commend you because you always remember me in everything and keep firm the possession of the traditions, that is, the substance of my instruction, just as I have verbally passed them on to you. So Paul here is pointing out the fact that the Corinthians, by and large, always wanted to do the right thing. That's why he's so complimentary. And this is why they also had so many questions, because they wanted to do the right thing. And they usually did as they were told of Paul. But what they were unable to do was to extrapolate and apply his teachings to their particular day-to-day situations. And then, when they tried to extrapolate and apply these situations to their lives, they would tend to go to the extreme. Examples are where they decided that maybe they shouldn't have any sex at all, since sex was abused by others, or wanting suddenly to dump all non-believing spouses in order to do, quote-unquote, the right thing, or saying, well, you know, we're free now. We're free in Christ, and we shouldn't have to worry about those other guys just because they don't feel comfortable with the idol worship issue or eating the meat. No, Paul taught, had to ultimately say all things are lawful but not expedient, so that they would do the right thing. Now, they were very concrete learners, as you can see if you've read it, and you will see if you haven't read it yet. And so everything had to be spelled out for them in as much detail as possible. And if you understand these facts, you'll see why Paul said what he said and wrote the way that he wrote to them. Now, having set that tone, Paul gets into the meat of his subject matter in verse 3, where he writes, "But I want you to know and realize that Christ is the head of every man, And the head of the woman is her husband, and the head of Christ is God. Now, as we read this, the first thing that you must understand is that the term head here does not imply supremacy. What it means is the source of. The woman came from the man originally, and the man came from Christ, and Christ was begotten of God the Father. Now, although all of this is true, the main point is about honor and respect. The woman voluntarily submits to the man's authority and respects him as such, being equal to him in God's sight, but of course yielding herself to God's order of things, because it's God that made things the way that they are. He has ordained it to be so. And so these are things that are put into place because this is the way that he wanted us to conform. He has a divine order of things, and we are to respect that and submit to that. And so the woman voluntarily submits to God's will in relation to her husband, and the husband submits to God's will in relation to Christ. And Christ voluntarily submitted to God's will in relation to the Father. Things simply work best when we do things God's way. So that's what this is talking about. It is setting up the order of things as God has ordained it. This has nothing to do with supremacy. It is simply the way that God arranged things for man, knowing what is best. So now Paul has, he has no interest here in simply laying out some hierarchy. It's not some, this one's over, that one's over, this one over that one. No. He was not trying to set up some hierarchy in these verses. He is not trying to put anyone, quote unquote, in their place. We're talking about the divine order of God. And you'll see as we get further into this, why he said what he said. And so he used these verses essentially to as a preface to the following verses you'll see when he really gets into his real subject. All right. Now, in this upcoming section of scriptures, Paul's main concern is reverence and worship and relationship, and also resolving a dispute which had a cultural twist to it. Now, the matter of wearing a head coverings or veils, although seemingly insignificant to us now, it actually had become a fairly big problem in Corinth at the time because of two cultural backgrounds colliding as the Jews and the Gentiles endeavored to worship together. Now, Jewish women always covered their heads in worship. And actually most of them covered them when in public, period. Worship being a place where there's extra respect given, the head covering was a big issue for them. Now, for a woman to uncover her head in public, period, was a sign of loose morals and a lack of commitment and respect for her husband, if she had one. And a woman's hair was special and considered personal, only for her husband to see. Now, on the other hand, Greek women were quite used to worshiping without head coverings. Now, as far as the men go, unless the man was sworn to a Nazarite vow in a Jewish culture, having long hair like a woman was associated with being a pagan, a temple male prostitute. Now, of course, in certain areas, actually, of the Near East, the desert climate with the sand and the wind, head and face coverings were a very practical utility. It was a practical matter. It was wise to use them. That had nothing to do with respect or morality in that sense. And so as far as the coverings, head coverings being a sign of modesty and fidelity, an extreme example of this actually still exists today when you see the outfits that are worn by women in fundamentalist Muslim-dominated cultures and countries. Largely, we find those in the Middle East. Now, in both situations, the women were also expected not to speak actually in public, with very few exceptions. That same kind of thing is true now in some of the more extreme examples of, again, the Muslim-dominated cultures today. Now let's go ahead and take a look at verses 4 through 6. Starting at verse 4, any man who prays or prophesies with his head covered dishonors his head, which is Christ. And this prophesies means teaching, refuting, reproving, admonishing, and comforting. Basically what you know of as preaching. Verse 5, Paul goes on to say, and any woman who publicly prays or prophesies when she is bareheaded dishonors her head, which is her husband. And it is the same as if her head were shaved. Verse 6, for if a woman will not wear a head covering, then she should cut off her hair too. But if it is disgraceful for a woman to have her head shorn or shaven, let her cover her head. So in that situation, a shaved head for a woman would be a disgrace. And so Paul says if she worships without a head covering, she may as well have a shaved head. He's just trying to make a point here. This is not a salvation issue. It was not and is not an essential for salvation, but the reasons had merit, that's for sure. And ultimately, the more conservative choice was the most expedient one in Paul's mind and in his teaching. So Paul proceeds to make his reasoned, logical case to the Corinthians, Corinthian Christians in this matter. So let's see what Paul had to say in verses 7 through 9 as he goes on forward. He says, for a man ought not to wear anything on his head in church, for he is the image and reflected glory of God. His function of government reflects the majesty of the divine rule. But woman is the expression of man's glory, which is his majesty and preeminence. And verse 8, for man was not created for woman, but woman for the man. And verse 9, neither was man created on account of or for the benefit of woman, but woman on account of and for the benefit of man. Now, first I'd like to point out that the use of the term preeminence here in this reading states the point in terms that are more extreme than are necessary here. But I did want to stick and stay true to the text of the Amplified Bible, so that's why I went ahead and read it. Now, the point here is that is God's ordained order of things as they have occurred in time since creation. And the ramifications of that order for relationships and worship. But remember, it's just like the meat-eating issue. It's not something that determines salvation or not. If someone had no issue or knowledge of these things and worshiped God, their worship would not be rejected by God. It would be accepted just like anybody else's worship that had head covering, or in the man's case, not had head covering. It would be a non-issue. But in this case, in this time, in this place, in this circumstances, it became an issue. So Paul used what he knew to deal with the matter, and he gave the best argument that he knew to explain the reason for it. Okay, next we look at verse 10. It reads, therefore, she should be subject to his authority and should have a covering on her head as a token or a symbol of her submission to authority. that she may show reverence as do the angels, and not displease them. So here we have really more of the same explanation and argument, but just with the addition of angels as a potentially offended being. Wouldn't get too heavy into it, wouldn't focus too heavily on it. It's just part of the same argument. In the next verses 11 and 12, read, "Nevertheless, in the plan of the Lord, and from his point of view, woman is not apart from and independent of man, nor is man aloof from and independent of woman. For as women are made from man, even so man is also born of woman. And all, whether male or female, go forth from God as their author." So Paul is very careful and quick to point out that neither gender is more important. It is simply a matter of function that God has ordained relationships between himself and Jesus, Jesus and man, and men and women. So now, having made this theological argument as to the God-ordained order of things, Paul appeals to the Corinthians' common sense and accepted esprit de corps and conduct. So let's see what he says in verses 13 through 15 on this matter. He says, "Consider for yourselves, is it proper and decent, according to your customs, for a woman to offer prayer to God publicly with her head uncovered? Does not the native sense of propriety, meaning the experience or common sense reason itself, teach you that for a man to wear long hair is a dishonor, humiliating and degrading to him? But if a woman has long hair, it is her ornament and glory. For her hair is given to her for a covering." So Paul is saying here, not only is the woman's head covering in worship something that clearly was expected by virtue of her longer hair than men, he actually felt like longer hair on a woman proved that she needed a head covering. He felt like that was the whole reason why they have longer hair. But although he used it as evidence of need for a head covering, he made it clear that it did not prevent her from needing other covering on top of her hair or in addition to her hair when worshiping. Now, it was indeed a disgrace at the time for a man to have long hair because of the clear-cut connection with the temple prostitution. Now, it was equally bad for a woman to have a bald head or a shaved head. Her hair, is her glory, and baldness was a definite disgrace. So now it appears that Paul is talking to Christian Jews for the most part, because when he says these things, because he speaks of this custom, and he uses God as a singular rather than the usual plural gods when talking about pagan or Gentile issues. Okay, and now we look at verse 16, which is the culmination of this first portion of the chapter, and really is summing, sort of a summing up of Paul's position on this matter. And verse 16 reads, "Now if anyone is disposed to be argumentative and contentious about this, we hold to and recognize no other custom in worship than this, nor do the churches of God generally." So this was an accepted and expected thing to live by as far as the women having their head covered in worship, church worship. And so the liberties of the Corinthian women just did not change the standards of church worship from Paul's perspective. Now, the custom was in place for a reason, he would think, and he would say. Paul felt very strongly that for many reasons, the head covering for women in worship should be the norm. Now, when you think about that, we talk about, so there's several scriptures that speak on, you know, a woman's part to play, if you will, in worship. But if you notice here, Paul is clearly saying that there should be a head covering. And if indeed you take the Bible absolutely literally and don't really look at the context and the times, etc., then I would imagine that women should have a head covering now. But have you thought about the fact why women don't have head coverings now? And clearly, I would say it's not a practical matter, and it's certainly not an essential. But have you just thought about it? Because it's so often that we take verses just like these and translate them and hold people to the absolute literality of the reading all the way down into the 21st century. So just think about that. As you notice, of course, that is not a practical matter in churches today, and nobody that I know of is held to it. So it's food for thought. And I want you to remember this when we get to the part about women speaking in church when we get to chapter 14. So stay tuned. And so now that does indeed end this section of this particular chapter. Paul has expressed the expectation that all women should wear head coverings during worship. And this would be a way to keep the peace as well as ensure proper reverence for God in worship and proper reverence in the household between the man and woman, respecting God's ordained order of things. Now, that also ends the section of the chapter where Paul was complimentary to the Corinthians. Because although he had to give them more detailed information and instruction on the subject of head covering, they had always tried to live by what Paul had taught them, sometimes to a fault. But the latter portion of this chapter covers a subject where Paul was not proud of the Corinthians, and in fact, he was extremely disappointed. Now, what we're about to study is just one example of what Paul has been trying to get across in his writings. For in all that Paul has taught us in his writings thus far, there is a common underpinning, a common thread to it. And what he's been talking about, once you've stripped away all of the language difficulties, cultural barriers, and bridging the gap of time between us and the first century church, in essence, Paul is simply and repeatedly saying for us to have common sense, common courtesy, and common love one for another. That is the core of what he is saying, and he is saying it so many ways, repeatedly, using various circumstances and situations that were presented to him to make the point. So in the first half of this chapter, these ingredients were present, and the Corinthians were doing the best that they could with the information that they had. And Paul was trying ever so hard to embellish upon his original teachings, to add some good advice and some sound instruction to go along with it, to help these very sincere Corinthian believers. But the root of Paul's frustration and disappointment in the rest of chapter 11 is that the Corinthian Christians had, in the manner of communion, failed to use common sense, failed to extend common courtesy, and failed to show common love one for another. Now, it wasn't complicated, and when we read it, you'll see that. So I'm not going to make it sound complicated. They simply did not show common courtesy. They simply did not show common love, and they simply did not use common sense. And so now let's begin to see what Paul was so very disappointed about as we look at the rest of this chapter. Now, as we prepare to see what Paul has to say on the issue of communion, there is some background information that is important to understand the issue at hand. Now, the early church, when the Lord's Supper was celebrated, it included a feast, or what was called the fellowship meal, and it was therefore followed thereafter with the communion itself. Well, in the church at Corinth, the fellowship meal had become a time when some ate and drank excessively, while others went hungry. Now, there was little sharing and little caring. And if there was any common sense, there certainly was not common courtesy and common love. And so with that, let's take a look at what Paul has to say in the next few verses, verses 17, 18, and 19. Again, reading from the Amplified Bible. He says, "But in what I instruct you next, I do not commend you, because when you meet together, it is not for the better, but for the worse. For in the first place, when you assemble as a congregation, I hear that there are cliques or divisions or factions among you, and I in part believe it. For doubtless there have to be factions and parties among you in order that they who are genuine and of approved fitness may become evident and plainly recognized among you." All right. And so what Paul is saying there is that cliques and factions, although they are created by those who do not properly discern the body of Christ and the spiritual meaning of the communion, and that's a bad thing, actually something good comes out of it. And that is that those who are greedy and selfish and not properly discerning the body of Christ and realizing the spiritual meaning of the communion, they would stand out. Those who actually have the proper perspective would be notable. They would be noticeable. And Paul himself was a great example, and that's why he says follow him as he follows Christ. So Paul is saying here, there's a bad thing, but there is a silver lining to the cloud. So what went on, you know, at these fellowship feasts that was so selfish and so inappropriate? Well, before we answer that question, I think we should see what Paul has to say next in verse 20. He says, "So when you gather for your meetings, it is not the supper instituted by the Lord that you eat." I thought we should look at that first, before we see the terrible things that they did. We should see what the statement that Paul makes. He is saying that as a result of their attitude and their actions, they're really not having communion. Their communion meal, their communion ceremony is legitimate. I mean, that's what Paul's saying. He said, "When you gather for your meetings, it is not the supper instituted by the Lord that you eat." So even if you take communion and you do and say the right things, guided by the pastor, dutifully, you could still be blowing it and doing it for nothing. You may be breaking the bread and drinking the wine, but you are not participating in the Lord's Supper that Jesus instituted and instructed us to partake in. So why does Paul make such a bold statement? Well, it becomes obvious as you read verse 21, where he says, "For in eating, each one hurries to get his own supper first, not waiting for the poor. And one goes hungry while another gets drunk." So the fellowship feast was not a fellowship at all. It was every man for himself. And those that had greater material means would make it into a big party and an opportunity to indulge their carnal desire. They would hurry and devour all that they brought to the feast so that they would not have to share with the poor. Or there would be groups that would come together that would share with one another but not share with some poor person that was not part of the group. Now, does that sound like the church that we learned about early in the book of Acts? That wonderful sharing, you know, all for one and one for all? No, not at all. Nothing like it. So don't get the idea that the first century church was perfect. By no means, it was not. But this is what Paul was intending to occur in each and every place, because it was according to and consistent with the teachings of Christ. but certainly they were not saints. So anytime somebody says, in the first century church, well, not the whole church and not on every subject. They had things and challenges just like we do. Now, on the surface, it may appear that, wow, those people are terrible. We don't do that. What is there to learn from this other than the most obvious? Well, there is something in here that Paul, I feel, and Paul agrees with me, that we really do need to learn here. There is a mistake that the Corinthians were making here that is critical to learn and not repeat. And I say that lesson is that it's because if you despise the poor, it is really making a request to God that he have no mercy for you, yourself. Now think about that statement, and you'll see what I mean a little bit later. If you despise the poor, you are basically saying, Lord, I want no mercy from you. I want exactly what I deserve. Grace is to give you favor that you do not deserve. Mercy is to withhold punishment that you clearly have earned and deserve. So you're saying when you despise the poor, Lord, I don't want any mercy. I don't want it. I want what I deserve. Now, God is not asking us in regards to the poor to meet every need that exists for every person that you encounter. Not at all. But you should not go out of your way to avoid sharing your blessings and prosperity. And if you say something such as, those poor people are in their situation by their own doing, you'll be correct for some, but you'll be wrong for others. And, you know, maybe you'll say, I didn't make them poor. Why should I sacrifice for them? Well, I would say to you, and Paul would say to you, well, Jesus didn't eat the forbidden fruit either. Adam and Eve did. Jesus didn't commit any of the sins that you've committed. You did. So why should God the Father send Jesus Christ to bleed and die for you? He didn't create your problem. And every bind that you get yourself in by your own decisions and actions, when you call on him for help and deliverance, why should he answer? It's not his problem. He has all that he needs. Why should he worry about your problems? Well, it's simple. He loves you. And then you can repay him in one way, in only one way, and that's by loving him in return. And Jesus said himself, if you love me, you will keep my commandments. And we all know that God's desire and his will is summed up, as far as his commandments are concerned, to love God with all of your heart, mind, and strength, and to love your neighbor as yourself. And so, knowing that, we ask the question, as we saw asked in the book of Luke, well, who is your neighbor? Well, in this particular instance, and always, it is the very one that you're tempted to despise, for whatever reason you despise them. But in this particular instance, we are reminded that it is so easy to give to those who are like you, or those who you expect to receive something in return from, or those for which you will get public accolades for your giving. But if that's where you are, then you've got it backwards. You've already been blessed. That's why you're in the position to help others. You are blessed to be in the position to help and to care for one or more of God's precious creatures that were made in his image, just like you. So which would you rather be, the one blessed to give or the one needing? So if you're in the position to give, and there are those who are in need, you have already been blessed with the awesome opportunity to be a conduit of God's love. Now, unlike Christ, who we owe a debt that we could never pay, we, unlike him, we are not capable or worthy of saving the world. So nobody's asking you to save the world. And as a matter of fact, we are not even worthy nor capable of saving our own lives and our own souls. If we were to nail ourselves to the cross and sacrifice ourselves, it would not be adequate. It would be pointless, meaningless, ludicrous. Your blood is tainted. Jesus is not. So nobody's asking you to save the world. You can't even save yourself. Okay? And that took Jesus. That took Christ. And you are only saved by grace. Not because of your smarts. Not because you're so great and so special. But there are, despite our imperfection, there are times when God deems us worthy of having the opportunity to manifest His love inside of us and to show fruit of it because of who you belong to. He gives you opportunities to give common courtesy and common love to other brethren. He's not asking very much. He has already Himself demonstrated the greatest example of uncommon love. He's just asking you for common love. Jesus Himself said, no greater love exists than when a man lays down his life for his friends. Nobody's asking you to give up your life. But when you've been blessed, your attitude should be different. So when you despise those that are less fortunate than you are, you don't deserve the opportunity to give. You don't deserve the opportunity to be the conduit for God's blessings to those who need it. And you're simply not a good investment for God. So this is something very important for you to think about. You know, why does God and why would God trust you with blessings? Is it for you to hoard it all for yourselves? I think not. Any unsaved secular humanist can do that. But as a follower of Christ, you should be different. Anyone can be selfish, greedy, condescending, inconsiderate, and prideful. And the truth of the matter is, without Christ, we're pretty much all those things. And having Christ in our lives, as the Lord of our lives, guiding our lives, and us embracing His sacrifice for us, and us being used to glorify His kingdom, that really is our only redeeming value. Because without that redeeming value, we're all selfish, greedy, tend to be and could be easily condescending, inconsiderate, and prideful. Again, we need to distinguish ourselves from secular humanists, because otherwise, what is there in our lives to draw men unto Christ? What is our redeeming value? I submit to you, our redeeming value is showing a light to the world, having Christ in our lives and manifesting that, embracing His sacrifice for us, and being a glorifying influence as far as the kingdom of God. So knowing this, you should realize that although blessed, you are no better than any other sinner. And you are certainly no better than any other person who happens to be saved by grace just like you, but just happens to be poor. Poor in material things. Because the truth of the matter is, if you've got this thing mixed up and you despise the poor, who is really the poor one? I dare to say I'd rather be a poor man in heaven, than to be a rich man in hell. No doubt about it. Think about that. And I hope you know the answer, the right answer. I hope you know the answer for yourself in your life. And if you don't, then I think you better work on it. So next, let's take a look at what Paul has to say in verse 22. So now with that in mind, let's read verse 22, where Paul says, what? Do you have no houses in which to eat and drink? Or do you despise the church of God and mean to show contempt for it, while you humiliate those who are poor, therefore having no homes or having brought no food? What shall I say to you? Shall I commend you for this or in this? No, most definitely I will not. And so unfortunately, they were disrespecting the purpose of the fellowship and they were disregarding the spirit of the communion and the Lord's Supper. And so Paul goes on further to say in verses 23 through 25, "For I received from the Lord himself that which I passed on to you. It was given to me personally, that the Lord Jesus, on the night when he was treacherously delivered up, and while his betrayal was in progress, took bread. And when he had given thanks, he broke it and said, 'Take, eat. This is my body, which is broken for you. Do this to call me affectionately to remembrance.' Similarly, when the supper was ended, he took the cup also, saying, 'This cup is the new covenant, ratified and established in my blood. Do this as often as you drink it to call me affectionately to remembrance.'" So this is the typical wording that occurs in a communion ceremony or service. And Paul is making it clear again, as he often did it, although he did not walk with Jesus during his life, he clearly had met the man and it had much revealed to him directly from Christ, further legitimizing his apostolic authority and position. And so Paul goes on to say in the next several verses, 26 through 29, "For every time you eat this bread and drink this cup, you are representing and signifying and proclaiming the fact of the Lord's death until he comes again. So then, whoever eats the bread and drinks the cup of the Lord in a way that is unworthy of him will be guilty of profaning and sinning against the body and the blood of the Lord. Let a man thoroughly examine himself, and only when he has done so should he eat the bread and drink the cup. For anyone who eats and drinks without discriminating and recognizing with due appreciation that it is Christ's body, eats and drinks a sentence or a verdict of judgment against himself." So, in order to take the communion worthily, you need to have an appropriate reverence for the purpose, for the sacrament, and the occasion. You also must understand the meaning of the communion itself. This feast was a way of celebrating. It was also a way of them being avoiding being hungry when the actual ceremonial communion was taking place, so that people were not taking the communion and thinking about filling their bellies. It was not supposed to be food for the body. It was supposed to be food for the soul. It was supposed to be a ceremony that reminded you, that renews your understanding and appreciation for the sacrifice that was made for you, that Jesus felt physical pain and suffering and bled for you. This is what it is supposed to remind us of, that fellowship together. And the one thing that holds us together, that bonds us all, is that momentous occasion and the death and, of course, the burial and resurrection of Christ. And so it was never meant to foster drunken behavior, gluttony, or selfishness. And some people will talk about one other aspect of it. I'll just touch on this, the fact that apparently some folks would have food that they could have eaten at home and yet waited to come to this fellowship to voraciously eat up the food, and therefore create divisions and arguments. And however that may be true, what Paul is talking about here is those who brought food and hurriedly ate it, often along with their familiar cohorts, their cliques, and not leaving any left over for those who were poor, who really didn't have enough substance to bring to the fellowship. This was clearly not what God would hope for. Now, this next verse is pretty heavy. Paul says in verse 30, that speaking of the careless, inappropriate, and inadequate reverence of the purpose of the communion, he says that type of careless and unworthy participation in the communion is the reason why many of you are weak and sickly, and quite enough of you have fallen. Quite enough of you have fallen into the sleep of death. Those are pretty heavy words. He is saying that, you know, he's already said that if you take communion unworthily, you are calling down a punishment onto yourself, a judgment on yourself. And he follows it up by making it clear that this is real. I mean, he says that for that reason, he's letting them know that for that reason, unworthily taking the communion, there are some that were sick and who were dead. Guess why? Because they despised the poor, because they didn't discern the body of Christ, because they disgraced the very communion itself. Okay? They did not get mercy. If you read back in the Old Testament about King Hezekiah, the prophet came and told him, I believe it was Isaiah, came and told him that he was going to die. But the king begged God to extend his life and reminded God of all the things that he had done, bringing Israel back to proper worship of him. And God extended his life 15 years. That's mercy. That's mercy. And every day that we receive beyond the current one is mercy. And these people who were sick in their bodies and who were, and some of them who had died premature deaths, it is because they had not received that mercy. So when you despise the poor, when you defame the purpose and ignore and disrespect the purpose of the communion, you're asking for trouble. I wouldn't do it. So many people don't take the communion because they don't think they should, because they don't speak in tongues, or they haven't been whatever, baptized. None of those. This is not what it's about. It's about the spirit of the issue. It is about understanding who God is. It's about respecting what Christ did for us. That's what it's about. Okay? So like I said before, to despise the poor is to request no mercy from God. Paul put it rather plainly, I would say. And then in verses 31 and 32, he goes on to say, for if we searchingly examined ourselves, detecting our shortcomings and recognizing our own condition, we should not be judged and penalty decreed by the divine judgment. But when we fall short and are judged by the Lord, we are disciplined and chastened so that we may not finally be condemned to eternal punishment along with the world. So basically, it's appropriate for you to check yourself first before God has to do it for you. Plain enough, coming from Paul. And now the final couple verses, verses 33 and 34, they read, so then, my brethren, when you gather together to eat the Lord's Supper, wait for one another. If anyone is hungry, let him eat at home, lest you come together to bring judgment on yourselves. About the other matters, I will give you directions personally when I come. So here we see touched on the matter that I mentioned briefly earlier, and that is the fact that some folks who actually had food at home would come to these gatherings just for the food. They wouldn't bring their own. They would come and partake of the feast before the communion, and just to ravage and to grub up on other people's food, that was not okay. Realize that if you'll notice that Paul is not teaching against those who would want to eat up their food before those freeloaders. It was actually the fact that some were poor and didn't have any food or enough food, and they were trying to keep them from getting it. And that was the problem, because that really speaks to the core part of you that is selfish and corrupt and greedy. Not so much that you would want to hold your stuff back from a freeloader who came just for to eat off of you. So the bottom line is that the fellowship before the communion was supposed to have a positive influence and a positive purpose. You know, if no one went to the communion hungry, then they would not be distracted, and they would not have an inappropriate attitude toward the food, toward the sustenance that was used for the communion itself. That was the idea. And so with that, folks, we are done. And the take-home messages are, number one, use common sense, give common consideration, and also extend common love. And in doing so, you will see uncommon results. So if you show common love and common consideration, you will see supernatural and uncommon results. Secondly, the issue of head covering was that of respect for God and respect for your spouse and accepting the God-ordained authority and order of things. And this was done through traditional dress at the time. And finally, number three, as a take-home point, the communion is serious business. And because of what it represents, we need to approach it properly. Doing it for the right reasons and with the right attitude, understanding the real purpose of the communion itself. And as it turns out, I do have a song for you. It takes as its inspiration the very communion that Paul is speaking of here in chapter 11. I pray that it blesses you. I pray that it reminds you of the essence and the purpose of the communion. And if we remember Christ for what he did, breaking his body for us and shedding his blood for us, I hope that it leaves us grateful as we remember his sacrifice. And being grateful, hopefully we recognize who we belong to, and that we will recognize that we are God's gift from himself to himself, and that the gifts and talents that we have are his hidden treasure, and that we will uncover that treasure and yield it to God for his use and for his glory. Enjoy the song, and I'll look forward to next time. Bye-bye.